good horse, I call you my shiny black bear.
When she hears your needs without hearing any criticism or demand, and you hear her needs without any criticism and demand, the solution will find you. The conflict will resolve itself.
From somebody else.
And one of the chiefs who hadn't spoken yet said to me, if we know how to communicate this way, we won't have to kill each other. So it just took 1 hour to see that if they can just stay connected at the heart level, nobody has to die. There's plenty of resources for getting everybody's needs met.
I know good hearts amongst the rich ones, how oft times we go there, an unwelcome.
You're listening to episode 603 of Unwelcome Guests, Ancient Languages of the Future, Part 2. I'm Robin Upton, and the voice you just heard was that of Marshall Rosenberg, whose ideas on nonviolent communication seem to me to have a lot of applications in the area of gift economy in particular, and re-envisioning the society that we would like to live in general. But before we hear the conclusion of his talk, we're going to hear the conclusion of Professor Daniel Everett's talk from earlier this year.
And I want to talk primarily about values right now. So what are values? Values are things that we believe are important. And it's not just enough to say what values people hold, but it's important to say in what priority they hold those values. I often hear the expression that everybody's basically the same, we have all the same values. Well, we do share a lot of values with people wherever they're at in the world. But not only do we have some different values, but we rank our values in different ways. So let's say that you have two societies and they have the values good food, hard work, being fit. I bet everybody in here would say they're a fan of good food, they're a fan of hard work, maybe, and a fan of being fit, okay? Now let's say that the most important value to you is good food. And the next is hard work, because you got to pay for the good food. And then finally, you know, if you get a chance, being fit, right? Somebody else says, no, my values are being fit is most important, then hard work, and then good food. You get different people who hold the same values but look very differently according to the way that they structure those values. So what makes a culture? It's the people we imitate. It is the people who share with us the most values ranked in the most similar fashion. The more people we find like that, the closer we are in culture to them. And as we do this, we form groups very naturally. This is the force that creates tribalism, and it produces divergence in age that is further reinforced by age, income, geography, and history. Tribalism is a very important force in the world, and one part of tribalism is very important, that is the mastery of local knowledge and imitation of people who know solutions to local problems. That's very important for the diversity of the species and the survival of the species. Another kind of tribalism is the tribalism of the world, national, nation imitating nation. That has its advantages, but it also has its severe disadvantages, because with that can come the loss of local knowledge. Finally, we come to signs. Signs are the bits of meaning. This is the fundamental difference between humans and all other creatures in communication. We are able to systematically agree as a society. Aristotle talked about this as our conventions on what a particular word means, what a particular sign means, what its form should always be. And we create these, and these give us language up to a point. So what are some signs? A noun, John, J-O-H-N, that's the form, and the meaning is the person that refers to. Verbs, run, R-U-N, and the meaning is that action of running. Parts of words such as S-I-N-G-S, that means third person singular subject, that's just agreed on by everyone. We have constructions which shows that signs are not just words. How many, you probably wouldn't say this, but it's popular on bumper stickers in the U.S., the hurrieder I go, the behinder I get. Although we all know those words are not grammatical, hurrieder and behinder, and nobody usually says that. I've never heard anybody say those outside of this construction. We all immediately know what they mean, because it's a sign that's based on other signs, like the bigger they are, the harder they fall. So we get a sign that's like a sentence sign, and we can tweak it in little ways and build other sentences. So we imitate one another's signs. We can innovate them. If we innovate slightly, other people can follow us. If we innovate too much, they can't. So if you're a scientist like Murray Gell-Mann and you find a particular kind of particle that's not like any other particle and you want to give a name to it, maybe you need to invent a new word. Or you could just borrow one from James Joyce called quark and call these things quarks. But that's innovation. How do you learn what the word means? You have to learn what the concept is. So some innovation is important. So we ask, those are the cognitive platforms for language. We need all of those things that we've just talked about to have language. And fortunately, we do. And we're the only species that has all of them. Then we need physical platforms for language. It doesn't do any good to have a brain if it doesn't have any physical way to manifest itself. So we need genes. Some people have claimed that the FOXP2 gene is the language gene, but actually that's not the case. FOXP2 is found in other species, and it has a range of functions in humans, which include the controlling of sequential muscles and sequential activities, which language certainly is one of those. We all have parts of our brain called the basal ganglia that control repetitive sequential actions. They're involved in bicycle riding and putting sentences together. And we have areas that have been talked about, but which I'm not really sure exist, Broca's area and Wernicke's area, supposed to be specialized regions of the brain for language. One thing we do have that everyone agrees on that is unique to humans, dedicated specifically to talking, is our vocal apparatus. Chimps are different from humans in that their trachea and esophagus are higher up, their tongue is farther up in the mouth, so when they make sounds, they can make sure their trachea is not connected to their esophagus, so they can eat and not worry about food going down the trachea. Humans have evolved in such a way that the tongue goes back farther into the mouth. When it does that, it elongates the vocal apparatus. It changes the relationship of the trachea and the esophagus. It produces one wonderful result. We can produce what no other species can produce, the vowels, E, A, U. Those are found in all languages of the world. They're the most important vowels. They're the easiest to hear apart. If you got those vowels, you can think about having a good speech system. The trouble with those vowels is to get them and put the tongue back farther in the mouth, we can choke to death if we talk with our mouth full. So that's a little trade-off. But we thought that it was important enough to have E, A, U, evolutionary theory, evolutionary forces did, that it was willing to choke a few humans to death to get that. The basal ganglia are connected throughout the cerebral cortex, and they govern a lot of actions. There's really nothing, and I'll tell you that, and you can check it out for yourself. There's really nothing in the cerebral cortex that seems to be dedicated to language. And there's nothing anywhere in the brain that seems to be dedicated to language, but the basal ganglia are fundamentally implicated in speech because speech is a sequential habitual activity, and that's what they do. Some people have argued that over years that there's an area called Broca's area and Wernicke's area, and these are dedicated to language. Several difficulties with this idea. First, take a little child, take those parts out of their brain, and what will happen? Not much. They develop language. Take them out of an adult, and they lose language, perhaps, certain parts of language, but they also lose other things. Both of these regions, which are extremely difficult to define spatially, have a range of functions. They're not just language areas. The other fact is that anything I know is in my brain. You know, so I know how to make authentic Mexican burritos. That's in my brain somewhere. I know how to tie my shoes. That's in my brain somewhere. And it tends to be stored in certain areas because certain kinds of knowledge are similar and they require similar skills, so they tend to be stored in the similar part of the brain. That doesn't mean that tying shoes is innate. It doesn't mean that making burritos is innate. It just means that they have to be stored somewhere in my brain. The human vocal apparatus, as we said, it's dedicated. So if you look at the parts of the human vocal apparatus, the nose, the upper teeth, all of these things, none of them are specific to language. We'd have all those anyway. What is different is the shape, the tongue being farther back in the mouth. The rest of it is just exploiting what we have to make sounds. You can think of human speech as, you know, irritating thing I used to do as a child was take balloons and let the air out really slowly and make squeaky sounds, and adults didn't tend to like that. That's basically how we talk. We let the air out of this balloon, our lungs, and we control the squeaky sounds with our mouth, tongue, teeth, and we get language out of that. Not really profound, but that's specific to humans. Well, you could ask, could there be language without this vocal apparatus? It seems that speech follows language, if anything, because there are languages that are possible without speech. So let me give you an example from Peter Hahn. This is whistle speech that doesn't have consonants and vowels, and you can watch this for a little bit. So he thought he was being filmed making a bow, making an arrow. So he didn't want this other guy bothering him. So the other guy's whistling to him, saying, "Whistle, show them whistle speech." And he's just ignoring him. And then he says, "Show them whistle speech," and a little pejorative thing in there, something humorous. And he starts laughing and talks to him. He says, "Let's whistle." So he whistles to him, "I'm making an arrow. I'm going to hunt." That's one way to do it. Another way is hum speech. Okay. So whistle speech is used for men when they hunt. Several languages in the world have whistle speech. So could Neanderthalensis have whistled instead of using consonants and vowels? Because we know they didn't make the same vowels we do. Yeah, they could have whistled. They could have communicated in other ways. In all the societies that I know of in the world that have whistle speech, and there are quite a few, only two do women whistle. In almost all of them, whistling is exclusively for men. And in English and American society, if one sex wants to communicate to the other by whistling, which sex will it be? Hum speech is used by anybody, but it's particularly used by mothers with children. And children often learn their language first through hum speech in Pitahan. So where does language come from? We have signs, these things that are form and meaning. Now, we don't have a vocal apparatus that can utter three words at once. We have to have words come one after another. So that's the beginnings of what is called syntax. We got to order these signs in some way. And there are a couple of very simple principles. And the simplest one is we have slots, positions, and we have fillers, things that can go in those positions. So the subject slot is filled by a noun, the predicate slot is filled by a verb. And these are fairly simple aspects of syntax. And syntactic structure, which is grammar basically, is to string words together with those closer in meaning being closer to each other. And it involves recursion. Recursion is the ability to put one thing inside another of the same type. And I'll give you examples of that. It involves several other things. I got interested in linguistics because of these diagrams. These are called Reed-Kellogg diagrams. I haven't found anybody over here who did them. They're certainly not done anymore in the U.S. It's probably more a sign of my age than anything else. But when I was in eighth grade, we had the diagram sentences like this. This is why I'm a linguist. I thought this was just great. This is one thing I could do that I actually liked in school. And they show the basic meaning relationships among words and parts of words and phrases. Chomsky, Hauser, and Fitch argued that there's one more bit besides this. There's something really important, and it's called recursion that apparently no other animal can do in the world. And that's the ability to apply a process to itself. So if I make a noun phrase, make another noun phrase inside that noun phrase, make another noun phrase inside that noun phrase, keep going. John said that Bill said that Mary heard that Peter thought that Jim believed that the house that Jack built was under a tree on top of the father's, brother's, sister's, aunt's, friend's, neighbor's hill. Okay? You probably wouldn't utter that, but you could if you wanted to. Okay? And you didn't have any problem accepting it as English, even if you don't really know yet what it means. You have to think about it. Okay, these things occur in written language more than they do in spoken language, but they're very important. And the claim was that all human languages had to have this. Pitahā is one of two languages that are known, believed not to have recursion. And I made this claim first in a paper in 2005, and you would have thought I had done something really evil. But in recent years, this is... been corroborated by an experiment by a bunch of work at Tufts University by a couple of linguists there, and they claim that not only does Pitahā lack recursion, but one language called Riau of Indonesia also lacks recursion. And at MIT's Department of Brain Cognitive Sciences, there are other experiments going on that show that recursion is missing in most of the places we would expect to find it. They're ongoing. So what does that mean? It means that there is no one structural principle that is that unifies all human languages. It also means, with all these other things we've seen, that there's not much left for a language instinct or a universal grammar to do. A language instinct, by the way, is sort of oxymoronic, because an instinct is something that cannot be learned. If you can learn it, it's not an instinct. If you learn language, language is not an instinct. It may be driven by an instinct, which I call the social instinct, but there isn't evidence for a language instinct per se. That means that, as we said at the start, what makes humans human, what makes us who we are, is not the fact that we're hardwired to unfold like a shoot of corn, which has double the genes that we do. You know, 23,000 genes for humans and over 40,000 genes for corn. Why does corn need more genes? Because it's stupid. It can't learn very well. Human genes have enabled us to have the kind of brain that's flexible, that takes us through various environments, and it means that all humans can learn a language. Here's an interesting prediction of universal grammar that is often overlooked. It predicts that not all humans should be able to learn all languages. How does it do that? Because if language is carried in the genes, we know that genetic mutations take place all the time, and we know that culture is one of the forces that selects among those genetic mutations for which will survive and which won't. So take lactose tolerance, the ability to digest milk products after infancy. Very few peoples in the world have lactose tolerance. We happen to be some, and it turns out, big surprise, the people who have this produce cattle. So we find lactose tolerance in Africa, we find lactose tolerance in Europe, but there are a lot of places we don't find it. You don't find it in the Amazon. Try to serve a slice of cheese to an Amazonian Indian and they may vomit. They don't have the ability to digest that. They can keep it down, but it's not something that they like. And it's common among many Asian peoples. It's a gene variation that is about 7,500 years old, very recent, favored by cultures. Another example, less roughly 3,000 years old, is the ability of certain people in Tibet to produce oxygen more efficiently at higher altitudes than other people. And they made a cultural decision to live at higher altitudes. The genes followed, and we know that's the case. Now, Indo-European languages, English and French and Spanish, we were all the same language 6,000 years ago. It was called Indo-European. And over those 6,000 years, we've become the separate languages that we've become. But remember, we carry all these similarities because we used to be the same language. That's one reason that these languages are so similar. And so in these 6,000 years, English has developed a characteristic that's very old that means we always have to have a subject in the sentence. So we can't say in English just something like rains today. We have to say it rains, even though it doesn't mean anything, right? What rains? We just have to say it because we have to have a subject. Now, in Spanish and Portuguese and many other Romance languages, you don't need a subject. You can just say rain. So in Portuguese, you say chove. And it would be, you couldn't even say Eli Chove unless you meant something weird about a man that was raining or something like that. So in those 6,000 years, which is plenty of time within the scope of genetic alteration, it would be quite possible to imagine that cultures would put pressure so you didn't have to learn that distinction. It would just be favored by the genes so that maybe you couldn't learn a language that had to have subjects, or you couldn't learn a language that didn't have to have subjects. This idea has been developed in a couple of books by the evolutionary biologist and phonetician Philip Lieberman from Brown University. It's an interesting prediction. If grammar is carried in the genes, it ought to be evidenced by the fact that not all humans can learn all languages. But if grammar is not in the genes, it's a function of general human intelligence and problem solving, then all humans ought to be able to learn all languages. So we can ask ourselves, is there anything left that we need universal grammar to do? I've given this talk at some academic audiences that are relatively hostile to the idea, and I say I've not proved that universal grammar is false. I've just said it's not really necessary. I don't know what work it does based on what we have to explain. If I am correct that human language is the result of culture and grammar working together, and that doing this stores local knowledge and teaches us things about one language not being exactly like another language, then it's very important that we study endangered languages to learn more about the nature of human beings. There are 7,000 languages spoken in the world today. 98% of those languages are spoken by roughly 2% of the people of the world. Each one of those languages is a tool that has been created to solve local problems. It is full of all kinds of information about the local environment with literature and traditions that could teach us all a great deal about what it means to live life in this world. As they disappear without being studied, we lose knowledge that we'll never be able to Google. We'll never find this knowledge again. It will be lost forever. That's why it's important to study this and value all peoples of the world and value diversity and realize we often learn the most from the people who are least like us. If we just talk to the same people all the time, we're like a friend of mine, a philosopher, who says he doesn't read anymore. If they agree with me, I already knew that. If they disagree, they're wrong. If we don't want to be those kind of people and we really want to learn from everyone else, we need to experience diversity, appreciate diversity, and learn from others who are unlike ourselves. Thanks very much.
And the full Q&A is available from this show's website. I've had to trim a few questions to fit this into the time available.
What is your take on the idea of a single origin for language? Is that basically the origin of universal grammar, or is it something different? Do you think it's poly-origin or single origin?
I think it's quite plausible that all human languages originated in Africa over 150,000 years ago. That would do a lot to explain similarities among the languages of the world today. It wouldn't explain all the similarities, and it doesn't have to. There are a number of other things that would explain the rest of the similarities. So I don't have any proof that that happened. But it seems likely that the first bands that cooperated and had community, that's what you had to have to leave Africa, could communicate, which probably means they all had language when they left, and probably since there were so few humans in the world at that time, it was the same language.
What generates language within a human being? So if you didn't teach a human being any words or any language, could they spontaneously generate language? And I know there's been some case studies around the world where, like, children grew up in the wild and they didn't generate language. So what do you think generates language?
As I say, language is a tool for solving the communication problem. An individual by themselves really has no one to communicate with, so language doesn't develop very well. Two individuals together would be able to develop some language, and we have a lot of evidence of this. Not a lot of evidence of just two people that have been found, but we do find that languages, there are a number of characteristics that I discuss in the book. Culture is certainly not the only thing. There are a lot of things that shape the kinds of languages we can have that are independent factors. But it's the social instinct, it's the need to communicate that causes us to try to solve that problem. And it turns out there's only a certain amount of solutions to that problem for people, for creatures that are like us.
What was your experience of how important what you could call knowledge economy was in their society? What I mean by that is that materially probably they're not, you know, like the West.
Right.
But as you were saying, because being hunter-gatherers, they had a lot more leisure time.
Right.
And I gathered that they didn't just sit there. They were doing things.
They do tend to just sit there and talk. Right. Eat potatoes out of the fire and talk about the fish that got away. That's the most common thing.
So in talking about the fish that got away, did knowledge play an important role in the status that people had in their society?
People have pretty much the same knowledge base. There are clearly people who are born more talented at hunting or fishing, but there's no social stratification among the Pitahā. And there's no Pitahā who can't do everything another Pitahā can do. They just may not do it as well. So if you're going on a hunting trip and you know this guy hunts better than you do, you'll probably invite him to come. You won't let him be the boss, but you probably follow behind him. He better not tell you what to do, but you'll do it anyway because you know he's a better hunter. So there are different skills, but in terms of people who specialize in knowledge, I've never seen any evidence for that in Pitahā.
Sorry, just capitalizing on this question, is there any competition and rivalry between them? And if so, is it reflected in the language? Are there comparative adjectives, for instance?
There are no comparative adjectives in the language, so I worked on this for a long time until I realized there aren't any. But They of course, there are times when you know, they'll play with each other and show, you know, I can paddle the canoe faster than you, or but usually they don't have games like this. In fact, one time when I was still a Christian missionary, I tried to organize a game day. I don't know why I thought of doing that, but I thought I would organize a game day. So I tried a race, and I showed them the race, and one guy, they all take off, and one guy's in front, and he stops. And I said, what are you doing? Waiting for them to catch up. So they tend to do things together, and competition is not strongly developed.
Okay, but this lady there, yeah.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that the Piraha don't talk about the past and the future. So how does that work in terms of storytelling? Do they have storytelling in terms of the past?
They don't mark tenses on the verb. Clearly, the Piraha know that something happened before or it's going to happen after. So they can talk about the past and future. They do not talk about the distant past or the distant future. So they don't have creation myths. I remember trying to collect creation myths, and I said, so what was the world like long ago? What do you mean? You know, long ago, what was the world like? I said, you know, when there were no trees. You've seen there are no trees? There was a time when there are no trees? No, but I mean, you know, there were no trees. Who made the trees? Trees have always been here, as far as I know. So they don't have any creation myths. They don't have any stories about God. You tell them about God, and on the film, if you see the full version of the documentary, the Piraha say, we really don't want what's up there. We like what's down here that we can see. Seems to work.
I've just been sitting here. We're at the LSE, and I've just been sitting here thinking about an anumeric cognition. And I just, is the division of labor within the tribe, is the exchange, how do they manage sort of trade and those sorts of affairs?
Yeah, well, you can get big pile, little pile. They do have that. They don't have specific words to mark bigger pile. Well, so you take a bunch of Brazil nuts. You're a Piraha, the river boats come up, and you know they like Brazil nuts. So you carry this big 50 kilos of Brazil nuts, and you dump it on the floor of the boat. What's he going to give you? You don't know, but it better be a big pile. And if it doesn't seem as big as what the other guy gave you, you're not going to trade with him anymore. Do you need numbers for that? Say I tell somebody I want three fish. That doesn't make any sense. You're going to get the fish. I mean, if you want a lot of fish, you're going to owe me a lot of fish. So they have those kinds of concepts. Somebody asks, you mean mothers don't know how many children they have? Why would a mother need to know how many children she has? She knows all their names. She knows what they look like. She knows what she feels about them. In fact, it can be a disadvantage to count them. If you saw the great American movie Home Alone, when Macaulay Culkin was left behind, his parents left him behind because they counted everybody and counted the neighbor boy. Then the neighbor boy went home and he was upstairs sleeping, but a Piraha mother would have never left him. She looks him in the face. Oh, you're here, you're here, you're here. She doesn't think, do I have any more children? She knows how many children she has, but not by number. I believe that language influences thought. I believe thought influences language. I believe language influences culture, and I believe culture influences language, and culture influences thought. So it's not just a matter of going in one direction. All these things are symbiotic. They work together to create the whole. So, yes, it's true that some, you know, so my son's recent article, I'm just so happy to see my son's name on an article that I don't care that he's wrong. And the fact he argues that it is, they don't count because they don't have numbers. I argue that they don't have numbers and they don't count because they don't need either. That it's the culture that does it. But there's a fine difference. I think it's important, but I don't think they're mutually exclusive at all.
And just because they can't express regret, they don't have the concept of it?
They don't seem to show any signs of worry. I haven't done psychoanalysis with them, and you really would have to do something like that to say they don't have regret. But I remember during my Christian days when I was trying to tell them a story about how God had been so good and changed my life, I told them about my stepmother committing suicide. It was a very painful story for me. So I went into this in great detail and told them, and I finished my story, and I told them how God changed my life, and they all burst out laughing. They laughed, and I said, what are you laughing for? You people kill yourselves? That's the stupidest thing we ever heard of. So they don't have a concept of suicide, and you don't see people sitting around depressed and worried. I mean, I've never seen... Part of the reason is if you do that, nobody's going to feed you. You've got to feed yourself. You've got a responsibility to yourself and to your children. But I've just never seen any signs of it. I have not done any systematic studies of it, but so far the evidence looks like they're pretty happy.
I assume that they don't keep any written records, they don't do any writing. Do you think, how do you think that would evolve the language?
Well, they wanted to learn to read and write because they saw me writing all the time. And, you know, I was writing all the time. So the Brazilian riverboat came up, and they have a pigeon language, a sort of very simple trade language they use to communicate with Brazilians. And the Brazilians said, he speaks the language. How does he speak the language? And they said, he sits on his butt all day and writes things. And so they saw me writing, so they would start to give me little squiggles and tell me what they meant. And then they realized there was actually a system to it, so they asked me if I could give them classes. And so we started classes, and one day I wrote on the board the word migi, and they all read migi, and I thought, this is great, this was pretty quick, and then they all started laughing. And I said, what are you laughing for? That sounds just like our word, for ground. I said, it is your word for ground. Oh no, we don't write our language, is that what you're doing? Yeah, well, we don't want that. So that was the end of literacy.
You've indicated that there's some controversy about your work, and it's not very welcome in the Chomsky camp. What's their main objection to what you say, and what do you deal with it? Because I don't know what the controversy is like. What's your main obstacle that you have to...
It's hard for me to say. I've been told lots of reasons that have to do with my parentage and all sorts of things. But it seems to be the fact that Chomsky's work over the last 60 years has been very rich and important in the history of linguistics, but it's really nothing formal has remained. He started off talking about deep structure and surface structure. None of these ideas are around today. About the only core idea for Chomsky that remains is recursion and universal grammar. In Chomsky's theory, there's a recursive process that builds all structures in human grammars. And it's not, if that doesn't exist, if that's not necessary, there's nothing left of the theory. This is, you know, many linguists have discussed, I've seen linguists discuss, why do they get so mad at Dan? Because it's an interesting question sociologically. It's not interesting to experience it. Part of it is because I'm an abrasive personality. And, you know, so I take some of the blame. And I, when, you know, when people say bad things about me, I don't tone it down. But basically, it comes down to that. If I'm right, that's wrong. And therefore, I can't possibly be right, and it's wrong. The press also irritates people because, you know, for some reason, this gets a lot of press, probably because Chomsky's so famous, and that irritates people. But I don't write the press reports. I answer questions, and people use that however they want to. You can find out what I believe by reading the book. And my favorite review of the book so far has, although the one in the Sunday Times, I love Brian Appleyard. I could have written that myself. Love that man. But the one in The Economist said that it was modest and reasonable. I like that. I like that. That's what I tried to be in the book.
I was wondering, with the spread of especially English and also Spanish and the globalization of language generally, and the fact that these smaller languages do tend to be dying out somewhat, do you think that in the future that's going to change the study of how language works?
I think that we're going to a lot of these languages will disappear before we ever study them, which will mean we will never fully understand the full range of human capabilities. The more these languages disappear, the greater the loss for science and what we can figure out about what it means to be human. There are so many levels at which all humans lose when each language is lost. To me, the best analogy is from... You know, I have profound taste. So the best analogy for me is Obi-Wan Kenobi in Star Wars when the planet, whatever it was destroyed. And he said, you know, something has happened to the Force. That's sort of how I feel about losing an individual language. Something has happened to the Force of human beings that can never be recovered.
Innovation and imitation. I wonder if you have a view or can expand a bit more on what it is that makes innovations stick or catch on, both in language and more broadly in our society, and whether that's primarily just about their usefulness or whether it's more broad than that.
It doesn't seem to just be usefulness. I mean, there are a lot of changes that happen to languages over time, expressions that catch on, that become very popular. And if we look at styles, you know, I noticed that I don't see any hot pants in the States anymore, but I've seen quite a few of them since I've been over here. I suppose they're called hot pants. But why do those catch on? Why does a joke catch on? Why is some joke funny? I don't really know. I don't think anybody has a good answer, because it's not just utility. There's something about it that it has to do with the relative prestige, maybe, of who started it. It has to do with, so there's some utility in there, but there are a number of other things. So I don't think people know why languages change exactly the way they do, why new words become popular, why new products become popular. Sometimes it's hard to figure. I mean, I have never played a video game in my life. As far as I know, I never will, although I know a lot of people who do. It's just not going to catch on with me. I'm the wrong place. My iTunes library of about 10,000 songs has a few things after 1969, but not much.
As an ex-Chomskyan myself, I just wanted to try and put you, at least to articulate your position a bit. The thing about human language is that it is learnt by little children, and there's been quite a lot of studies done to show the way children learn language, and there is a clear process by which this happens, and that certain things don't happen if they aren't done soon enough. So, for example, if you're learning somebody else's language and you get exposed to it too late, probably your phonology, your phonetics, will never be quite perfect.
Right.
Those sort of things suggest that there's something pretty intimate about human brains and language, and maybe universal grammar is a way of getting at that. Maybe it's a too crude a way, and it's universal grammar sort of fades off. But nevertheless, you haven't actually said anything about maturation.
I do in the book, and let me just say that children are ferocious little learners. They learn language, they learn all sorts of things, probably faster than adults. Language is just one of the many things. Piaget actually had a good answer to that many years before universal grammar, and he said, part of what children do when they learn their first language is construct their own identity. And in the process of constructing who they are, the language learning process for them is very different than the language learning process for an adult, which is learning another language not to construct their first identity, but for any number of other reasons. Having said that, I do believe that there are adults that have learned languages as adults that speak them at native speaker level. You'd have to show that children learn languages better than adults, you'd have to do more studies than we've currently done. To show that the stages of language development are unique to language, you would have to be able to distinguish and tease those apart from all other forms of development that children go through. And there are no non-controversial studies that separate those. So the maturation is certainly real. It's certainly something that happens. Children learn first languages better than adults learn second languages, on the most part. Whether it's universal, I don't know. We also don't know if everybody learns to speak equally well. This is a common claim of universal grammar. All people learn to speak equally well by a certain age. I don't know if that's true. But how would I know it's true? You'd have to do studies. You'd have to be able to test and say what it means to say. And I think that people learn language just good enough to get by. That's how most of us do it. If I need to make academic discourse, I will learn how to communicate in such a way that I can do it. Otherwise, with my buddies, I'm not going to talk like the way I'm talking to you right now. I'll talk in some other way. And it depends on the friends you keep, how you're going to learn to speak.
Language is so much about agreement, and you talked about how some people on one side of the river develop a different language than the people on the other side of the river. Is there any evidence that you've come across where those different people are interested in the differences? I mean, you talk about the importance of studying endangered languages. Globalization is basically, all for all its benefits, is creating a lack of diversity, you could say. So is there something that is going to encourage us as human beings to be open to what is different, a different language?
We tend to act in our own self-interest. We have several forces at play within us at any one time. One of the strongest forces is tribalism. To define our own group, the group that we feel comfortable in, the group that we most imitate. And how do we define other groups? Like the Pitahā, we may call them crooked. Like the Greeks, we may call them barbarians. Like some people who are very religious, we may call them infidels. But we define our own group, and people who are outside that group are somehow inferior to us. This is, unfortunately, a natural human tendency. And to overcome it, we have to have strong self-interest. How we ever overcome it amazes me, but we have overcome it. In the history of the world, humans are the only species that I know about that have worked to feed others that have no chance to pay them back, for example.
So you mean somewhere we have to have a self-interest, not only in something different?
Yeah, it's not. I mean, some people like to learn things that are different. You'll find inquisitive personalities, but there has to be self-interest. Having said that, humans are cooperators and have an altruism that hasn't really been well explained, why we want to help others that don't have our genes. And somehow we do. You know, we risk our lives for people we don't even know. That's not the selfish gene explaining that behavior. There's just something about that I find admirable. So I don't always regret being a human being.
Well, amen to the importance of human altruism. It seems to me if self-interest was really a dominant human motivation, we would have died out a long time ago. We're now going to continue from last week with Marshall Rosenberg, a man who has, I think, a very sharp understanding about human motivations, about what people need, and why this is different from what they say they need. Now, I could summarize what he's talking about in nonviolent communication as a kind of language 2.0, where people give up traditional ways of thinking and speaking, ones that involve trying to have power over other people, and embrace something which may be unusual, but is perhaps a more natural way of being. The way that a baby, for example, starts to communicate. No idea about deserving things, whether good or bad, but a joyful receiver and giver of gifts. Now, regular listeners to the show will be familiar with some of my ideas about the importance of gift economy and of overcoming the image of man as a selfish maximizer. So I would encourage you, if you're working on gift economy software, local community, or if you know people interested in the gift, then to spread this around and have some reflection on some of the deeper ideas that Marshall Rosenberg is getting at. Slightly like we heard the other week about the NGOs, because they operate in the money system, they end up getting controlled by the same people that control the large corporations. Even with a lot of good people in them, the organizational form is very counterproductive. It seems to me the current role of the economic system is not to keep a lot of greedy, selfish people in check and make sure that their needs get met, but is to keep a small 1% of sociopathic and psychopathic greedy elite in a position to effectively control the huge majority of humanity and prevent their natural altruism from manifesting itself. And let's get back to Marshall Rosenberg. So here is the conclusion of last week's show on nonviolent communication.
Different ways that people respond when they hear a demand. My preference is for how my youngest son once responded when he heard a demand. I said, "Would you please hang up your coat?" He said, "Who was your slave before I was born?" I see. I like that way because I know he hears a demand then, right? It's pretty clear. Now, then there's other people who it's harder to guess that they're hearing it as a demand. For example, you say to them, "Would you please come over and just sit on the couch with me and talk with me?" The person goes like this. Okay. Now, if you're smart, you'll say, "Oh no, stay away." They're hearing a demand, you see, but they're giving in. But the worst case scenario, this is the dangerous one, you see, is if the person hears your demand, your request as a demand, and they respond this way. "Oh, sure, sure, I'll do it." And they do it. But they did it to buy your love. They did it because they were afraid that if they didn't, you wouldn't like them. Now, how will you find out? You'll find out eventually. You might find out like this one woman did who showed up at my door. 2 a.m, my doorbell's ringing one morning. It's pouring rain outside. And this woman, not 8 months pregnant, crying, "Come in, come in." I sit her down in a chair. "What's going on?" I didn't know how she got there, but she told me that her mother had been in a workshop with me a month before, and she had just called her mother up to tell her about what happened, and the mother said, "Oh, there's a man in your town that you might want to go and talk to." So that's how this woman shows up at my door at 2 a.m. Now, what was the problem? Earlier, she said, "I just made a little request to my husband and he said, 'Get out!' We've been married 8 years. He's always been so loving, so kind. He's done everything I want. And now he says, 'Get out!'" Already I knew what the problem was. He was a yes-saying jackal. He hears somebody he loves wants something, and he feels he has to do it to buy love, to prove that he's a loving person. And so how does she find this out? It took 8 years, but then she pays for it one night. And I know I was right. How do I know I was right? I got him out of bed. Why should I be up at 2 a.m. talking to his wife while he's sleeping? So I call him up and invite him over, and sure enough, you see, he was a yes-saying jackal. He just didn't know how to say no. So he had been giving in for all these years, and then finally this night he snapped. So that's how you find out. After 8 years, she found out that he was hearing demands and lovingly giving in to them. You certainly don't want to ever receive those messages, any one that you've just responded to. Never hear what a jackal-speaking person thinks, especially what they think about you. You'll live longer. There's only two things that human beings are ever saying: please and thank you. That's all human beings are ever saying. The only thing is, jackal-speaking people have learned to say please in a suicidal way. Think about that for a moment. What else are human beings ever saying except please? You're behaving in a way that isn't meeting my needs, or my needs are not getting met by something else. Would you please do this to meet my needs? When our needs are not getting met, we need to know how to say please in a way that makes it enjoyable for people to give it to us. All right, this morning we learned how to do that. Just learn how to say what you are feeling and needing and make a clear request. Make sure that no words come out of your mouth that imply wrongness on the part of other people. Do everything you can to promote in people the trust that when you make a request, it is a request and not a demand. And that increases the likelihood that people will enjoy giving to you. So we studied that this morning. Now, the other half of the process is how to receive from other people what's alive in them and what they are needing to make life wonderful, and how to receive that without hearing any criticism or demand, just to hear what's alive in them. And we need to learn how to do this even when these other people are saying please in this strange way that we've been educated to say please. You know, you were all speaking perfect giraffe for about a year. See, so what I'm teaching you now is really not a second language, it's really your first language. I'm bringing you back to life, to nature, to your first language. So now the other half. How do we respond to a jackal's please when a jackal is expressing the please this way? The problem with you is that you are too, see, that's please. That person's in pain. That person has a need that isn't getting met. And isn't it sad that they only know that way to ask for it? Isn't that tragic for this person? To be saying please in a way that almost guarantees you're not going to get what you want. Or if you do, it's going to be motivated by fear, guilt, or shame, and you're going to pay for it. How sad to be educated that way. And now, of course, it would be even sadder if when the person says please that way, you don't hear the please. You hear a criticism. And that's when we have war. See? Somebody in pain does their best to express it. Person on the other end hears a criticism. So let me tell you what the person that you were working on this morning, all of the messages that I heard you relate, that what you predict they might say back, here is what I heard the person saying. I heard the person you're speaking with saying this back to you: I'm in pain. I have a need that isn't getting met. That's what the person was saying in the message that you wrote down. Now hear that. Put on giraffe ears and say this back to the person. Are you feeling? And guess what that person is feeling when they say what they did. Because you are needing. And guess what their need is. So I'm asking you to go back to the message that you predicted you might get back. I'm wanting you to imagine the person actually says this to you. And now if you have giraffe ears on, here will be your reaction. Are you feeling? Guess their feeling. Because you are needing. Guess their need. With giraffe ears, all you can hear are feelings and needs. You can hear no criticism. A number of years ago, I was working with a group of women in religious life, and they had a conflict for some 15 months that was creating great pain within their community. And they asked me to help them resolve this. And I suggested that we begin by having everybody express their needs. What needs of yours are not getting met in this situation? And after the first speaker, second word, I could see why. After 15 months, not only had they not been able to resolve the issue, but why it was causing increasing pain. Can anybody guess what the second word was? First word was I think. That's as soon as I heard the second word, I could see why. Notice my question of them was, what needs of yours are not getting met? And instead of an answer, I got, I think. Immediately I knew trouble. And here's what the rest of the message said. I think that if we are to be in religious life, we must take our commitment seriously and address in an appropriate way. See, I asked for a need. That's what I got back. And then another religious sister said, Sister, I agree, but I think 15 months. What was the issue? The issue was whether to wear traditional clothing or not. 15 months, had not been able to resolve it. In fact, at great pain in that 15 months, the community was divided. And I asked, what are you needing? And I got thoughts. So it took me a while to teach them never to hear the thoughts. Only use the thoughts as a window. Look through the thoughts to the needs that are behind. Hear the needs behind. It'll be a whole different world. Don't hear thoughts. They finally got it. They finally started to look through the words, the thoughts, to what was behind. And then it was amazing how in a short time we resolved the conflict. My partner Ruth Bebermeyer was with me at the time and saw this miracle that comes whenever we hear through the words to what's behind them. I feel so sentenced by your words. I feel so judged and sent away. Before I go, I'd like to know, is that what you meant to say? Before I rise to my defense, before I speak in hurt or fear, before I build that wall of words, tell me, did I really hear? Words are windows or they're walls. They sentence us or set us free. When I speak and when I hear, let the love light shine through me. There are things I need to say, things that mean so much to me. If my words don't make me clear, will you help me to be free? If I seem to put you down, if you felt I didn't care, try to listen through my words to the feelings that we share. Words are windows or they're walls. They sentence us or set us free. When I speak and when I hear, let the love light shine through me. So, with your giraffe ears on, you hear the feelings behind the words. You hear the need. Every moment we have feelings and needs. So we're hearing the truth. What's really alive in this person now? It's better for you to hear only that, because then you don't live in a world of criticism or judgment. You take away all power from other people to dehumanize you when you have giraffe ears on. You never have to worry about other people's reaction to what you say. You can be honest without fear, because you know I don't ever have to worry about how others respond. Only what ears I have on to respond to their response. But I can control that. I can't control how others respond. And if I'm going to worry about something I can't control, I'll become a nice, dead person. You see, I'll be afraid to reveal myself for fear. What if they say this? Well, who cares what they say? If you have giraffe ears on, it's a gift. All they're saying is, please, please. So let's hear the please behind the message that you hear. First read off the message, and then let's hear how you heard the feelings and needs behind it.
What I expect my daughter would say was, I can't control myself when I'm so angry.
I can't control myself when I'm so angry.
And when I thought about it, I would think I could say, are you feeling frustrated because you are needing some other ways to express your anger?
That's what I ask you to do, to try to hear the feelings and needs. And even if that's not accurate, notice what it does, even if it's wrong. It demonstrates a value. It demonstrates that you value what's alive in that person, that you're taking the time to try to connect with what's alive in that person. When people trust that that's what's interesting to you, already we can solve anything, you see. What makes it hard to resolve things is when people feel the other person is only interested in winning. They don't care about me. They're just out to show me that I shouldn't do this. But by just stopping and trying to connect, you've demonstrated a powerful value, that you value what's alive in her.
Related to my son, are you feeling distressed, confused, because you are needing help?
That's the idea. Again, even if it's not accurate, brings the other person's attention to their needs, gives them a chance to correct it. Better to be guessing wrong what a person needs is than to hearing what they think. You'll be living in a different world when you are trying to connect with their needs than the world you'll be living in if you hear what they think.
I need some help in addressing the answer that I got back, which was one of the things that you said before lunch, which can be the most dangerous when somebody just said, you make a request and somebody says, yes, I'll do that.
Yeah.
What I wrote down was, are you feeling pain because you're needing recognition for the job you're doing?
Okay, I like that.
But it feels like there's a huge leap from the response, yes, I'll do that, to me asking that question.
Yeah, you're trying to sense what's really behind it. That's one of the two giraffe ways. The other possibility that would also be giraffe is to say bullshit in giraffe.
How do you say bullshit in giraffe?
I'm feeling uneasy with your okay. I wish I could trust it, but I don't. I'd really like you to take a moment and really tell me whether it would meet your needs to do as I requested. So that's when I would guess that the okay isn't okay. So that's how I would say bullshit in giraffe. Giraffes are not nice. See, much of, I think, the violence in the world is created by nice people. So don't mistake the word nonviolence as being nice.
Are you feeling abandoned?
Not a feeling. It's a thought. Don't encourage jackals to think that way.
Are you feeling afraid?
Now we're cooking.
Because you are needing reassurance that I will not disappear.
That your needs will be taken care of. Leave yourself out of the other person's needs. All of their needs can be met without you. How could I satisfy your needs? That's a jackal question. If the other person is smart, they'll take the Fifth Amendment.
This was an answer to when my daughter said, you sound like you're reading from a book.
You sound like you're reading from a book.
And I say, are you feeling scared, separate, or alienated? And are you needing to be responded to in a genuine, heartfelt way?
Yes. But you're doing it again when you do that. So with such a jackal for a while, until you make clear to them why you're doing it, so they will have less distrust of it, you would do just as you said, but silently.
Silently?
Yes. See, don't think we have to do this out loud for it to be powerful. It can be powerful if we don't say a word, as long as where our attention is here. You see. So you might have heard just that, but maybe not have said it out loud. Yeah, see, that's all you can hear with the giraffe ears on. And you can hear that even if you're silent. You don't have to say out loud. You could just have heard that. But you'll show that your attention is here from your eyes. Because when we're hearing what is in a person's heart, our eyes are different than when we're hearing a criticism or when we're making a criticism. Our eyes, it's not subtle. Now, the advantage in being able to say it out loud is the person can correct us if we're not accurate. But even if we don't say it out loud, we live in a different world when we're connecting here than when we're hearing criticism.
The question would be something like, I would like you to ask me for help if you need it.
Yes. And then the person responds,
I am afraid of becoming a burden.
No, that's it's almost a giraffe response. So how do you respond to this person? I'm afraid of becoming a burden. Now, if you're a jackal, you would say, no, you wouldn't be a burden. So if you're a jackal, you will try to reassure. Jackals try to fix people in pain. They try to give reassurance. They try to make it better. They can't stand pain. They immediately